It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the United States Supreme Court will weigh in on the legality of a question about citizenship on the upcoming 2020 census. We'll learn about why the Trump administration wants it asked and why there's been pushback. First, leaders from the Catholic Church are gathering this week for what's being called an unprecedented summit on clergy sexual abuse. Pope Francis called for the meeting last year as the crisis in the church has continued to worsen, including a new admission from Pope Francis about the sexual abuse of nuns and an accusation that he himself ignored abuse claims against the former Archbishop of Washington, D.C. Julie Zalzmer is a reporter who covers religion, faith, and spirituality for The Washington Post. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us some background on the origin of this, in effect, summit?
As you said, it's really the first of its kind, which is somewhat shocking when you think about it. The Boston Globe exposed sexual abuse in the Catholic Church back in 2002. And since then, this has become clear that this is not just an American problem, it's a global problem. There's been abuse scandals in Australia, in Chile, in Ireland, in numerous European countries. And it's taken until this point for the Vatican to convene the leading bishops from all over the world to get together and discuss what they should do about it.
What do we know about what they're planning to cover over the next few days?
They're specifically focusing on the abuse of minors, so they're not going to be taking up issues like you just raised about nuns being abused by priests, for example, or harassment of seminarians and young priests, which is most of what now ex-Cardinal McCarrick, who you mentioned, he was recently defrocked for harassment of both minors and adults. This is more narrowly focused, which is going to leave some people saying that they didn't address a lot of the issues.
And Pope Francis has said as recently as this month he wanted to deflate expectations for this meeting. What was his point there?
Right. It's not a great way to go in saying don't get your hopes up. It is obviously a big meeting that the Vatican is taking very seriously. It's pretty rare for the Pope to give two speeches in one meeting. He's going to open and close the meeting himself. They've gathered the presidents of every bishop's conference in the world, essentially. It's a big meeting, but what Pope Francis was saying in Deflate Your Expectations, he was saying we might not come out of this with the sort of concrete proposals that advocates want. This might not be a change in policy for the church. It might just be a chance to talk about the issue.
And you mentioned the internationalization of this problem, issues emerging in lots of countries. It seems like not that long ago that people within the church were talking about this as kind of an American problem. What's going on in the United States? That's no longer the case, it sounds like.
Yes, there's definitely been recognition that this problem exists in many other countries. However, I think that there is still tension between the way American bishops handle this problem and the way bishops the rest of the world over handle it. Back in November, the U.S. Catholic bishops had their major meeting of all of the bishops in the U.S., and they had planned to essentially devote the whole meeting to this issue, to sexual abuse. And they did have very concrete proposals written out that they were planning to vote on that were going to change the way they handled abuse and the way they handled bishops' accountability. And as that meeting opened, Pope Francis and the Vatican sent a letter to the U.S. bishop saying, don't do anything about sexual abuse. Don't take any action on your own. You need to be in harmony with the rest of the world. You need to wait for this February summit.
But waiting for this February summit, now that it sounds like may not come up with concrete recommendations like the ones the U.S. bishops had come up with.
Right, which leaves open the question of what do the U.S. bishops do with these proposals that they had indeed drafted that, while controversial, had quite a bit of support in the U.S. church. One option is that they have another meeting in June and they might try again to enact their own proposals and to go farther than the rest of the world. Another option that has been raised is that some American leaders at this summit might ask permission from the Vatican to enact some proposals on their own. Hopefully, these proposals don't just disappear.
Talking to Julie Zausmer, reporter covering religion for the Washington Post, looking at this big summit at the Vatican, looking at the issue of clergy sexual abuse. And Julie, beyond the abuse itself, of course, here in the United States, a big part of the story was how bishops, archbishops, cardinals handled these issues, covered them up, moved clergy around despite existing accusations of abuse. Are we seeing a similar pattern as these issues emerge in other countries?
Yes. I mean, I think that there is a difference from country to country. That you see a couple of countries, I think it's Costa Rica and Chile, where the bishops actually have designated other people to attend the summit on their behalf because they themselves.
We seem to have lost Julie Zausmer, our connection with her. We'll try to get her back. In the meantime, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this big summit at the Vatican looking at the issue of clergy sexual abuse. This story started fairly early here, emerging here in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and elsewhere. Is this something you've been following since then? Have you been affected by these issues? What questions do you have about this summit at the Vatican? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. And it looks like we have Julie back with us. Julie, hi. Do we have you connected again?
Yes.
Hooray.
Sorry about that.
Great. No, that's okay. It might have been on our end. So what are there critics within the Catholic Church looking at this big summit and saying, we need to do more. We need to tackle this issue a little more head on.
Absolutely. I am sure you will hear that, especially if the bishops emerge from this summit, as they're starting to say they might, without new policies in place. There's going to be protesters surrounding St. Peter's Square while these bishops meet in private who are going to be demonstrating for all sorts of things. There's going to be representatives of nuns who are abused, of seminarians who are abused, of children who are abused. They're all going to be standing out there waiting and hoping for real action.
And on the other hand, I've been reading there are conservatives within the church who are saying they're worried about what they claim is a culture of homosexuality, too much permissiveness from Pope Francis. What are we hearing from that faction within the church?
Yes. Whenever you talk about abuse, you pretty quickly get into the question of why the Catholic Church and why this problem is so prevalent among Catholic churches, just as it is in so many other domains of life, but there's something particular to the Catholic Church, and whether you're liberal or conservative or somewhere in between, your answer usually differs on that. There are many conservatives who blame gay priests. There are others who blame celibacy. There are others who blame the hierarchy and the culture of bishops. Those big questions of whether to change church doctrine on sexuality, on celibacy, on any of the really big topics, those are probably not going to come up at this meeting.
That reminds me, you've written about abuse scandals that recently emerged with the Southern Baptist Church, a very different organization of churches, much less hierarchical, much more independent churches, and yet we see apparently widespread abuse scandals emerging there. What do we know about that?
Right. The Southern Baptists in some ways are very similar and in some ways are very different. You mentioned the lack of a hierarchy. That's a big deal for Southern Baptists, which on the one hand means that you don't have one bishop who's keeping all the paperwork in his office and moving clergy from one place to another. On the other hand, it means nobody's collecting paperwork. And if a priest or a pastor in this case is fired for sexual abuse, he can go to the next church and there's no database that says, oh, this one's a problem. There's also a real focus on gender in the Southern Baptist Convention and on the difference between men and women. And men are supposed to be in charge in the church, in the family. That's the teaching of Southern Baptists. So there are a lot of people who are questioning how that plays into a culture of abuse. It's a different culture, but it's another culture that obviously has its problems.
Now, getting back to the Catholic Church, it seems like there may be some shifting attitudes toward Pope Francis. I think a lot of people were hoping when he became the Pope that He might be a breath of fresh air. He might tackle this abuse issue head on. Are people starting to rethink that now?
Yes. If you look at his polling numbers, and I know we don't normally think about approval polls for popes, but they take them just like they do for presidents. If you look at his polling numbers, right after the Pennsylvania grand jury report came out this summer, which really reignited the discussion about abuse in the Catholic Church, his numbers fell precipitously. People have been very disappointed in how he has handled this issue.
We're talking to Julie Zalzmer with The Washington Post, looking at this upcoming four-day meeting at the Vatican on the church's sexual abuse crisis. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching these issues and how the church handles them? What do you want to see come out of this meeting? Are there tangible things you think the Vatican could be doing, should be doing, to stop sexual abuse from happening in the church and to have more transparency when it does happen? If you are Catholic yourself, how has this scandal changed your relationship to the church? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation on clergy sexual abuse in the Catholic Church ahead of this big summit on that topic this week, organized by the Vatican. Julie Zalzmer is with us from the Washington Post, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of how Pope Francis has handled this issue so far? What kind of action would you like to see taken when a priest is accused of abuse? Are you relieved that this meeting has been called? Do you worry it'll be mostly talk, not so much action from the Vatican? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Julie, what have we heard from survivors groups? There are chapters here in Wisconsin and around the country, survivors of priest abuse groups. What are they saying about the latest from the church?
I think they've been waiting for this summit for months. It's hard to wait, hopefully, now that Pope Francis has essentially told them not to. One issue that survivors groups and others have raised is the makeup of who is participating in this summit. There's almost 200 church leaders who've been invited. Most of them are the presidents of bishops' conferences, so they're leading bishops. Out of almost 200, only 10 are women, who are women from religious orders. There's a serious gender imbalance here, and that has been concerning to some survivors.
Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in St. Louis. Chris, hello.
Hi. I'm a survivor in St. Louis, Father Leroy Valentine at Immaculata. And I wanted to kind of just bring to your and y'all's attention the abuse of the abused. What happens to survivors when we try to get help? And that brings up another problem that the USCCB was going to address in November, which is accountability for bishops, not just for the direct abuse that McCarrick did, but also, you know, the runaround, the gaslighting. I've had problems with Cardinal Dolan, Cardinal Burke, Cardinal Regali. And I don't see any accountability for that. And I was kind of hoping the Pope would address that issue after he killed the USCCB boat, but he didn't.
And Chris, can you talk about your feelings toward the church now? This is an institution that at one point in your life, I imagine, you trusted, you respected. How do you feel after, I guess, years of what's got to feel like betrayal?
Well, betrayal is exactly the word. I mean, I would still consider myself a Catholic in psychology, because I believe in the connection between faith and deeds, you know, Mother Teresa and all that, but the hypocrisy is overwhelming.
Chris, thank you for calling and for sharing your story. And I imagine, Chris, Julie, not alone with that feeling of betrayal.
Not at all. And Chris raises a really important point about accountability for bishops. What the American bishops wanted to do is probably not going to be taken up worldwide. But there's even more basic measures of accountability. The American church back in the early 2000s had a meeting in Dallas where they instituted zero tolerance. For a priest has one credible accusation, they're not a priest anymore. They're removed from ministry. And not every church in the world has that still in the Catholic Church. And that would be the kind of thing survivors groups would like to see and may well not see from this meeting.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Ryan in Boscobel now. Ryan, hi.
Hey, Ryan. Yep. How are you doing, buddy?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Oh, I think the Pope's just kind of hiding by himself, and I just wish he'd just address everything, like, really up front and, you know, just address the issue, you know, everybody sees it but him. I mean, I'm not sure. It's kind of scary, you know, and, you know, everybody believes in him, so, you know, I think if he says something, you know, they might believe it.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Julie, do we have a sense of why maybe Pope Francis isn't tackling this as head-on as Ryan and others were hoping he might?
It's a great question, and we'll see what he says when he gets to make two major addresses in the next few days. Every so often, he says something very candid about this, and then there's other times where he has probably regretted what he said.
Thanks for the call, Ryan. We're talking to Julie Zalzmer, a reporter who covers religion at the Washington Post, looking at this big conference at the Vatican, looking at clergy, sexual abuse, cover-ups, and more. Julie, let's dig in. One of our callers mentioned, you mentioned the U.S. Effort to come up with new rules, overruled in effect by the Vatican. What were some of the things that they had hoped to do?
They were focused on bishops. On setting up accountability measures if a bishop does something wrong or a bishop oversees abuse. There aren't clear guidelines for how you handle that right now. So they were focused on putting in place lay councils that would have the ability to sanction bishops.
Let's go back to our callers now. Patty is with us in New Berlin. Patty, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Patty?
Well, I just wanted to bring up, I was raised Catholic from nursery school with the Franciscan sisters, then I went on to Dominican sisters for grade school and high school and ended up with the Jesuits at the end. And the Catholic Church lost me when they canonized Pope John 23rd after he died after a few years, because he was obviously knew what was going on, and everyone forgot that he was doing a cover-up with everyone else, and they still canonize them. And to me, that's more of a mortal sin than anything I ever learned in school. So it's a big betrayal to me.
Patty, thanks a lot for the call. Julie, have we seen people, as Patty is confronting Pope Francis' predecessors and how they handled these issues?
Yes, so much of what has happened in the past year has not really been about current events. It's been about how bishops handled abuse years and years ago. Here in Washington, our Archbishop of Washington retired early after it came out that he had a very mixed record of handling abusive priests back in the 90s in Pittsburgh. And as we look at the church moving forward, there's an effort to say bishops, you know, shouldn't be named to new positions if they were a bishop at all before 2002, because just about everybody is tainted by this.
Thanks a lot for the call, Patty. Some of the most recent news here in the United States has been places like Pennsylvania, where you see prosecutors looking at lists of accused abusers. We're seeing people trying to come up with that kind of information in dioceses around Wisconsin as well. What's going on that front?
There are investigations inspired by Pennsylvania in more than a dozen states at this point. There are criminal investigations, there are civil investigations, and those take time, obviously, and they all just started this summer and fall, so it might be a while before we see results. But the Catholic Church is now a church under criminal investigation, which is a major step.
And there have been questions about how and whether the church hierarchy cooperates with secular law enforcement versus trying to deal with these issues internally. What's been the most, what's going on in the United States with that?
I think that probably was a large part of why the Vatican was uncomfortable with the U.S. bishops wanting to take action back in November. I think the U.S. bishops, by and large, are more comfortable working with civil authority than the Vatican and than bishops in other places in the world. The idea that bishops were going to relinquish some authority in some way to civil authorities, to lay people in their own churches, is something that does not sit well with all bishops.
We have another caller. Roger is with us in Milwaukee. Roger, hello.
Hi. I'm a married priest. I had 22 years in the priesthood, and I just say that as long as we continue, as long as the Catholic Church continues this hierarchy business and the bureaucracy, the problems will not go away with sexual abuse, because they'll always protect the clergy no matter what. And the lady's got to take charge and not be afraid. In the Middle Ages, they were afraid of the lady. That's why they put the kibosh on anything that the lady had to say. And as far as the bishop's meeting, there's some nice people there. Francis is a nice guy. I shouldn't say guy, but a wonderful person. But he still believes in the hierarchy and all that crap, may I use that word. You know, so nothing's going to change. So I don't know what the Catholics are going to do, but I just think that it's a big a scam that they think they're going to change something.
Roger, thanks for the call. Roger's saying nothing's going to happen until lay Catholics, I guess, rise up and confront the hierarchy. Thoughts, Julie?
I think it's a very tough question for a lot of lay Catholics who are distraught by this. Do you leave, or do you try to change your church from inside? And can you really do that? That's a lot of people have to wrestle with that.
Roger, thanks a lot for the call. Julie, what kind of signals are you going to be watching from that first address from Pope Francis as this thing kicks off?
I think it will be very interesting to see if he talks about accountability of bishops, or if he is focused simply on the sin of abuse and on priests who abuse, and pinning the problem on the priests themselves. If he's talking to the bishops about their own accountability, that's a sign that this meeting is going to tackle more of the most current issues.
Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Julie Zalzmer, the Washington Post reporter covering religion, faith, and spirituality. She was with us today to talk about what we can expect to come out of a 4-day summit on sexual abuse in the Catholic Church that starts this Thursday at the Vatican. Coming up after the news, we talk about some controversy surrounding the upcoming 2020 census and a question about citizenship that is going to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look ahead to the April election and the race for state Supreme Court justice. We'll find out who's running, what the issues are, and what's at stake for control of the court. First, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments about whether or not the Trump administration can legally add a question about a person's citizenship to the upcoming 2020 census. The census, which is conducted every 10 years, helps determine, among other things, how many congressional seats each state gets in Congress, and it can affect the distribution of federal tax dollars. Our next guest has been covering the 2020 census and that citizenship question. Hanzi Lo Wong is a national correspondent for NPR based in New York. Hanzi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, tell us what this question is.
The question asks specifically, is this person a citizen of the United States? Some people think this is about immigration status. This is strictly about U.S. citizenship status. So you can answer, yes, I'm a citizen, and you specify whether you were born in the United States or naturalized or born of parents who are U.S. citizens, or no, you're not a citizen.
And why does the Trump administration want to have this on the census next year?
Well, that's a good question. The Trump administration has insisted that it wants this question because it wants better data to better enforce part of the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which has protections against discrimination of racial and language minorities. And I say it's a good question of exactly why the Trump administration wants this question, because the federal judge in New York who has ruled, made the first major ruling here, he has found that explanation, that rationale, is what he called a sham justification. This is from U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman. He's citing, you know, voting rights advocates who say that there already is existing citizenship data from another Census Bureau survey known as the American Community Survey that is adequate for enforcing the Voting Rights Act. And so there are questions here exactly why, if you were to look at the emails and other internal documents the Trump administration has released, there are a lot of mentions about apportionment, which is a wonky term for how the U.S. government divides up congressional seats and electoral college votes among the states after each census. And there's some discussion in internal Trump administration discussions about apportionment and how undocumented immigrants have been included in those numbers, because every person living in the country is included in census numbers, regardless of citizenship, regardless of immigration status. And a big question is that a reason why the Trump administration wants a citizenship question?
We'll dig more into the backstory within the Trump administration. It gets complicated. But let's talk about the challenge to this idea of having this question. Who has challenged this question being on the census, and why?
Well, you have more than two dozen states and cities, as well as other groups, including a U.S. Conference of Mayors, a bipartisan group. And they're concerned that there's going to be an undercount of immigrant communities, communities of color, because this is known to be a sensitive question. And the Trump administration, through the Census Bureau, has actually admitted that. They also agree that this is a sensitive question. And Census Bureau research suggests that specifically they think 6.5 million people may specifically avoid answering this question themselves, self-responding, because of a citizenship question. And the concern here is that that will put a lot of pressure on the Census Bureau to try to make up for it. A lot of people don't answer the census in general, and so the Census Bureau has to send workers, go door knocking, try to get people to respond in the months after the forms go out. But a lot of advocates here are very concerned that with this question on the form, no amount of convincing, no amount of advertising, no amount of door knocking is going to get certain communities participating, and that would result in inaccurate data, inaccurate population counts for communities, for states. Data that will stay with us for 10 years. And this is data that how congressional seats, that's how they're distributed based on these numbers, but also hundreds of billions of dollars of federal funding, federal tax dollars that go to fund Medicare, schools, roads, basic public services, that is dependent on these population counts, not to mention the business community as well as health researchers that rely on the demographic data from the census. If it's inaccurate, that's going to have implications for the next decade.
Talking to Hansi Lo Wong, national correspondent for NPR, looking at the controversy over a question about citizenship on the 2020 census, maybe on the 2020 census. And now, Hansi, that question is up to the U.S. Supreme Court. What are they doing? When are they going to rule on this?
Well, the Supreme Court has agreed to have a hearing on this issue in April, the week of April 22nd. We don't know exactly when yet, and they're expected to make a ruling by the end of their term, their current term, which would be by June. And that's also when the Census Bureau says if we need to have a final form, we need to finalize exactly what questions will be asked, whether or not a citizenship question will be on the census. We need to know by the end of June so that printing of the paper forms can start on time this summer, and so the census doesn't go over budget. That's a very, very important deadline, because even though, it may seem very far away, the 2020 census, we're in the final months of the preparations, and there are a lot that has to be done in order to make sure that every person in the country is counted once, and counted where they live.
And did the Supreme Court expedite this? Did they jump in on this issue sooner than they would have under normal appeals process?
That's right. The Trump administration requested that even though it did appeal through the normal route, which is because it was in New York, it was appealed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, but it asked the Supreme Court to jump in and essentially bypass the Second Circuit before the Second Circuit even ruled in order to make sure that the Supreme Court could have a hearing and to make a formal ruling by the end of June.
Let's look inside the Trump administration. There have been questions about who initiated the idea of having this citizenship question. Can you talk about what we know about that backstory?
Sure. The Trump administration has insisted that they are acting because of a Justice Department request, a formal letter the Justice Department sent to the Census Bureau in December of 2017. But through these lawsuits, through internal emails and memos that have been released, and also depositions, testimony, sworn testimony by Trump administration officials, as well as their affidavits and statements, that has confirmed that, in fact, this idea of a citizenship question was discussed internally amongst administration officials long before the Justice Department put in a request. And in fact, it was the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, who oversees the Census Bureau, because of his pressuring and pushing of staff at the Commerce Department, they were the ones at the Commerce Department to ask the Justice Department to put in a request for a citizenship question. The Justice Department initially did not want to ask for a citizenship question. They did not want a request for one because at that time, according to these a memo from a Commerce Department official summarizing these conversations, he said that the Justice Department wanted to avoid controversy at that time. There was a lot about the former FBI director, James Comey. And so it is here we are. Justice Department did ultimately put in that request. But it really throws into question exactly where did this come from, this idea. And two other people, interesting enough, really we should take note of here, is former White House Chief Advisor Steve Bannon was a person who connected Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross with Kansas Secretary of State, former Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach. He was former vice chair of President Trump's now defunct Voter Fraud Commission. These two individuals were involved in early discussions and trying to lobby, essentially, for a citizenship question with Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross.
Do we usually, every 10 years or so, see a lot of controversy over what ends up on the census form, or is this kind of out of the ordinary?
It has been many decades since a new question has been added to the 2020 census or to the census form in general. There always is controversy surrounding every census because it has to do with money and power. But this is a controversy here that census advocates are very worried about, the citizenship question, that whether or not it stays or goes, people are very concerned that specifically immigrant communities, communities of color, that this has tainted the conversation, the national conversation about the census. People will associate it with that, and people, there are certain households, both non-citizens and some citizens, who may be very fearful and wary of participating in the census because of the citizenship question and because of the Trump administration's push to get one onto the census.
And looking a little deeper at what's at stake, you mentioned apportionment. This is something that could, when the census is done, determine, hey, some states gain a seat or two in Congress, some states lose one. I know there's some concern that Wisconsin, for example, could lose one. That is a pretty big deal, right? If a state loses some of its representation in Congress.
This is a very big deal, and there are a number of states that are on the verge of losing congressional seats. And another thing to keep in mind, those congressional seats are directly related to how many electoral college votes. So which states ultimately have a big say in the next, this is after the 2020 election, so it won't have an effect for 2020, but after that, that is going to have implications there. Another thing to keep in mind is that if there is a citizenship question on the 2020 census, that data could be used not just for apportionment, have an effect on apportionment, but also local redistricting. States and local communities can use that data in order to come up with legislative districts based on not the total number of residents, but specifically the number of U.S. citizens.
And finally, again, this is going to the U.S. Supreme Court. Since there hasn't been this kind of controversy in a while, do we have any kind of recent voting from U.S. Supreme Court justices that might hint at what they might do with this?
This is something I unfortunately don't have a good answer for you. I don't have a crystal ball, but I do. The only thing I can tell you for sure, this is going to have big, big implications. This is a case to watch because, again, this is going to affect and shape American life for the next 10 years.
Hansi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Hansi Lo Wang, national correspondent at NPR. He joined us today to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to hear arguments about a citizenship question that the Trump administration wants to put on the 2020 census. Coming up, it's Election Day in Wisconsin, and we'll dig into a big race that's not on today's ballot. Two candidates are seeking a seat on the state's Supreme Court. We'll look at that race and what's at stake. That's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the federal government says thousands more children may have been separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border last year than originally reported. We'll find out where the reunification process stands today. First, it's Election Day in Wisconsin with a lot of primaries for municipal, county, and school district races on the ballot. There's no statewide election today, but there are some recent developments in the race for Wisconsin's Supreme Court justice. It features judges Lisa Neubauer and Brian Hagedorn, who both serve on the Second District Court of Appeals. The winner of the April 2nd election will succeed Justice Shirley Abrahamson with a 10-year term on the High Court. Molly Beck is a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with a general look at state Supreme Court races in Wisconsin. They're nonpartisan, but they end up being pretty partisan, right?
Right. They are nonpartisan, but I would say they are nonpartisan in name only. You see these races in recent years have become, what one candidate, although there's not a D or R next to their name, they're either backed by mostly conservatives or mostly liberal-leaning supporters and donors. So while this is officially a nonpartisan race, they look, they walk talk and look like a partisan race. And this one is no different than that. The people running both campaigns have run, on the Judge Brian Hagedorn's side. He is backed by conservatives and former aides to Scott Walker running his campaign, and on Judge Lisa Neubauer's side, people working for her have worked on the campaigns of Tammy Baldwin, for example. So these are nonpartisan races, but only in name.
And looking at the current partisan makeup of the court, where does it stand right now?
So right now, it's still controlled by conservatives 4-3, and this. Whoever wins this election will not change that, because if Lisa Neubauer is elected, that won't change.
Right, because Shirley Abrahamson's considered one of the liberal justices, so no big deal, except 2020 is coming and another election is coming, right?
Right, that's the race that everyone's looking at that could change the makeup of the court or who controls the court, because if Judge Brian Hagedorn wins, this race, it will still be controlled by conservatives. And if Lisa Neubauer wins, she will still be in the liberal minority, or seem to be in the liberal minority. So it's the 2020 race where if a liberal-leaning judge or candidate wins, then the court would flip control.
All right, that's the big picture. Let's meet the candidates now. Tell us a little bit about Lisa Neubauer and her resume.
So Lisa Neubauer is, she oversees the state appeals court, which is the highest ranking position for a jurist in the state that is not on the Supreme Court. Brian Hagedorn is also on the state appeals court. They're both on the same court. He was appointed to that position in 2015. Before he was appointed to that position by Governor Scott Walker, he was Governor Scott Walker's chief legal counsel. Lisa Neubauer worked at a private law firm before she joined the court.
So they're both on the same court. That could be a little awkward, it seems like, running against each other now.
Right.
Now, what are some of the issues that people are looking at as we kick this race into high gear?
I think the issues right now, people are here. There wasn't a primary in this race, so we're just now learning a little bit about the candidates. Usually in these races, we hear more by now because there's usually a primary. But because there wasn't one, we're just now getting into, both candidates. And some of the issues that have come up so far are on Brian Hagedorn's side. He had written some blog posts many years ago when he was in law school that talked about his Christian faith and his opinions about, some Supreme Court rulings that were related to same-sex marriage at the time. Democrats have heavily criticized that, as they say that's disqualifying because he might, as a Supreme Court justice, take up issues related to same-sex marriage. On Judge Lisa Neubauer's side, critics have said that she's too political for the court. They cite her husband's involvement in politics and her daughter's involvement in politics. So those are the issues that are kind of bubbling up right now.
Talking to Molly Beck, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, previewing not today's election, but the general election race for the state's Supreme Court. Let's dig a little more into those issues you brought up, Molly. Brian Hagedorn, Judge Hagedorn, had written, as you said, about gay marriage issues, among other things, in the past. Also, more recently, talk about him helping found a school, a religious school that among other things, apparently would discriminate against people in same-sex relationships working there. Can you talk about the back and forth between his critics and his campaign on those issues?
Sure. So critics have brought these issues to light. Just recently, like you said, the liberal advocacy group One Wisconsin Now held a press conference about Judge Hagedorn's the school that he and his wife Christina helped found a couple years ago. I believe it was in 2016, and it's a Christian school that blends school in school learning and also homeschool learning. And when you look at the code of conduct, that teachers are given when they apply for a job there, it says that you're not allowed to be in sexual relationships, and if you are, then that could be grounds for expulsion. You could be dismissed if you're a teacher, and it also applies to parents of students there too. And beyond that, there have been some blog posts that have been circulating that where in one case, Judge Hagedorn called Planned Parenthood a wicked organization. In another case, he talked about there was a ruling that struck down anti-sodomy laws in Texas that was kind of a landmark ruling in the same-sex marriage debate, and he said that doing so could provide constitutional basis to legalize bestiality. And those things have obviously drawn a lot of criticism from liberal side, saying that he would not treat Planned Parenthood, for example, or issues related to abortion or homosexuality fairly if he was on the court.
And then his case and the case for his campaign sounds like, okay, he can separate his personal views and his legal views, and they make the case that he won't allow those personal views to taint his rulings. Is that the general gist of their response?
Right. Yes. They say that, they said that these criticisms are all based in his Christian faith, that they're all tied to his Christian faith. So they have said that he is being attacked for his religious views, and his critics are implying that there's something wrong with having a Christian faith and believing in some traditional Christian views. They've also said that, he's been a judge since 2015 and hasn't treated anybody differently because of his personal views and can set aside personal views on the bench.
And then on Judge Neubauer's side, we're hearing in the news today some criticism of Judge Neubauer for disclosures on her conflict of interest statements, saying she had stopped supplying information about people who had done business with her husband's business. Mm-hmm. What do you know about that?
Right. So about a decade ago, she stopped including in her statement of economic interest, which is basically a form that candidates have to file with the state that says here's everything that I'm tied to, that any business interest, so to speak. And so she had been including her husband's business's customers, and she stopped doing that about a decade ago because her husband was worried that competitors were going to pick off some of his clients. But critics on the other side are saying that this is, there's no way to know where she has a conflict of interest because she's not disclosing that.
So we'll keep watching those stories. Something that's happened a lot in our Supreme Court races in Wisconsin is big money from outside groups, not the campaigns themselves, plus outside groups. Are we starting to see much of this yet?
We're not seeing the big, big money yet, but I'm sure that will come in the near future. Right now, it looks like that Judge Hagedorn has a fundraising edge over Judge Neubauer, but overall she has in the recent filing he had an edge, but overall she's got about 300,000 more in the bank. So, but I expect a lot more money to be coming in as we get into March.
And I understand when Judge Neubauer announced in the race, she had called on outside groups not to spend and called on whoever might run against her. I think she was the first one in the race at that point to also call on outside groups not to spend money. Does that seem like something that's likely to happen? They'll say, okay, yeah, we'll hold off and not throw money at this race?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of candidates in the past have said that, but there's really no way for them to reject it, and I haven't seen anybody do that. So we'll be watching to see if she does that or makes any
moves to do that.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Molly Beck, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked with her about the race for Wisconsin Supreme Court justice between appeals court judges Brian Hagedorn and Lisa Neubauer. That election is April 2nd, and between now and then, we'll be inviting both candidates to join us here on Central Time. And, of course, you can follow election news at wisconsinvote.org. News and interviews and other information about candidates, races, and how and where to vote. You can check that out over at wisconsinvote.org. When's the last time you got an email or a text? If you're online, probably pretty recently. Okay, when's the last time you got a letter in the mail? Depending on how much you write, it might have been today. It might have been a long time. But how about this? When's the last time you got a telegram? A professor at Oakland University in Michigan just got a telegram last month, but it was sent 50 years ago. As reported in the Washington Post, Professor Robert Fink graduated from the University of Michigan back in 1969, and some friends of the family sent him a congratulations telegram with an apology that they couldn't make it to the graduation. That telegram was delivered to his apartment one day after he moved out. So he didn't get it until last month. How? The current occupant of the apartment went digging it through a file cabinet that was there when she moved in. Okay, the file cabinet apparently sitting there for 50 years. After some searching, she found an envelope with the lost telegram still in it. So she poked around online and tracked down the intended recipient, this professor, and got in touch. Now, he thought this was some kind of weird scam, but they got in touch and she mailed him the 50-year-old message. He says it was the first time he'd ever received a telegram, and probably the last time. Even if you wanted to send a telegram, Western Union closed their telegram business back in 2006. I'm Rob Ferret. Stop. This is Central Time. Stop.